history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories to be told. There are some men and sometimes women who did incredible things for our country, and we want to honor our veterans for their service, for the sacrifices they've made. We don't want to forget the price that's been paid for our freedom, and as we take that journey, we learn a lot, we're educated, we're entertained, and oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're going to hear one today in Porterville, California, from Jim McCrory. He's going to be 96 years old here in a couple months. He doesn't sound like it. And I'm going to test his memory by taking him way back to those early years in really wilderness here in this part of California. You said the West Hills, west of the San Joaquin Valley. If you go up there now, it's pretty dusty. You might find some rattlesnakes and lizards. But you saw a whole bunch of different wildlife growing up, huh?
I did.
What kind?
As a young boy, there were still a few antelope out there on that prairie. It was just a grass prairie in those days, no farming. I don't know how big it was because I was only a boy, but I saw some small flocks of antelope. I saw some elk, wild tule elk. There were no roads or power lines, but there were pipelines ran across there, and they had telephone lines up and down the pipelines. And it seemed to me, looking back, that almost every other telephone pole had a golden eagle on it. I never saw a bald eagle. They were all golden eagles.
Uh-huh.
But there were just lots of them. All of the antelope, of course, died when people would go out and take automobiles and chase them and kill them.
Hmm.
And the elk had to be rounded up and put on a elk sanctuary in Tupman down by west of Bakersfield,
uh-huh,
where they have quite a herd now, because you couldn't have elk anymore roaming free, you know, no more than you could have a grizzly bear.
Sure.
Of course, I didn't see the grizzlies. They were long gone.
You're not that old. I bet some of your ancestors did, because your family's been in California here for almost 200 years.
On my father's side, I believe the original McCrorys probably came here. I really don't know, but I know they were here in Mariposa in the 1860s,
uh-huh,
and in Visalia in the 1860s. And on my mother's side, they were here to be up with Sutter and even rented land from Sutter and farmed up there in the Stockton, Sacramento area.
Uh-huh.
So we've been here. In fact, some of my ancestors went to rescue the Donner Party.
Really?
Yeah.
You mentioned Visalia. And is it true that one of your ancestors is the only person in the history of Visalia to be killed by a lynch mob?
That is true.
And you're claiming it?
Oh, of course. I'm fascinated by him. I've really got acquainted with him through a Visalia police captain by the name of Terry Oman,
mm-hmm,
who was writing a book about the early day lawmen in the San Joaquin Valley. And he came across my grandfather, and being in law enforcement, he had access to the old arrest records, the old coroner's reports,
mm-hmm,
and that type of thing. He said how fascinated he was because he was a man of both good and evil. He was a family man with wife and children. He had a saloon. He was a businessman. He was a volunteer fireman. And he apparently was a cold-blooded killer.
Mm.
I don't personally know exactly how many men he killed, but one of my old aunts, I remember her clearly telling me as a boy, "Jimmy, he was a real nice man when he was sober, but he got mean when he got drunk, and he only killed 13 white men, and he killed a whole lot of Mexicans and Indians and Chinese, but they don't count." And that's because in those days they had no civil rights.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying what's right or wrong. I'm just saying that's the way it was.
That's the story that was told to you.
Well, that's the way it was in those days.
Yeah.
These people had no civil rights.
And you inherited your grandfather's name, but not all his character traits, huh?
Well, I hope not all of them. I hope I'm a good and decent man.
Well, you must be doing something right to still be going so strong at 95. I know we bounced around here, but going back to your childhood, I'm just imagining what it must have been like to grow up in such a rural setting,
mm-hmm,
surrounded by nature. Probably not a whole lot of interaction with other kids, huh?
We lived on a pipeline station. There were perhaps three other kids. There was a one-room schoolhouse. And I used to just go down there as a little kid to be with other kids. And I'd sit in there and I'd begin to learn as the teacher was teaching the others. So they let me officially go to school when I was five, which was a big mistake because I was the youngest kid in school from then on. So that when I was a senior in high school, I was only 17. I was only 16 most of the year. Being the youngest boy in a class at high school is not a good place to be. It would have been great if I was a sophomore.
Sure.
But not as a senior.
And I didn't ask, did you have brothers and sisters or not?
No, I was an only child.
Only child.
Always said that my folks took one look at me and said, we'll never make that mistake again.
Well, maybe they just knew that you were destined to be one of the few, the proud, the Marines, as we're going to hear about. But do you remember as a young boy having a dream, an ambition, an idea of, hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do this and this and this?
Yes, I do. At that time on the west side, there were a lot of flyers coming over in the old Jennies and that type of thing. And they were building those dirigibles, the Macon and the Akron, and they had them up at by Sunnyvale.
Yeah, Moffett
and
Field.
They flew a lot over the San Joaquin Valley. And I remember laying on my back in the grass watching them up there. And they had little airplanes that they put on an elevator and dropped down out of the dirigible. And he would fly off, and he would fly around a while, and he would come back and hook onto something, and they would pull him up. That all fascinated me. I wanted part of that. But my father had been a soldier in World War I, never went over to France, but he was a soldier, and his brother was a soldier, and another brother was also a soldier. And so I was very much interested in the military. I can't say that I dreamed of being a soldier at that time. I don't know really what I dreamed about. I was just kind of a lonely kid. And actually, at a very young age, I learned to read, and that just opened the world to me. I read insatiably. I can recommend that to anybody. It just opens the entire world to you to be a reader.
When you were a teenager, though, must have opened up a bigger world to you when you moved into a big city for your standards.
Lemoore. Probably a 1,400 population. High school, a lovely high school. In fact, the first money I ever earned, Uncle Earl had the contract to light the football field down there. And he hired me to dig holes. And he paid me like 35 cents an hour or something, which is an incredible amount of money in those days. And I so clearly remember working with Uncle Earl on that project of lighting the football field. When I got out of high school in 1938, the Depression started in about 1932 or 3, something like that. And it got better, but by 1938, it had regressed, and there was absolutely no jobs to be had. I so badly wanted to go to college, so I came. They had started a junior college in Visalia, and I took the entrance exams, which I always had a. I'm just telling you facts. I had a high IQ, so I had no trouble passing the entrance exam.
What do you mean had? You said you had a high IQ.
Oh, maybe I still have some of it. But anyhow, when it came time to go, I had absolutely no money, and no young man like me had a car. I had no way to go. So I really just could do nothing. Somehow or other, I don't remember how I did it. I got a hold of a pickup. I had a 60 cubic inch Ford pickup.
Yep.
And I got a rack thing on it, and I got a few dollars, and I made some money going around scrounging, buying calves and stuff and selling them at auction, just living by my wits. And I did that for two or three years, and by then they were starting to build the Army airfield out of Lemoore, and I got some work there. And then, of course, here came 7th December 1941, and from then on everything was, you know, just foregone conclusion of what would happen.
But you actually decided to enlist in the Marine Corps before Pearl Harbor.
Yes, I did.
What drove that decision? Where did that come from?
I had a very good friend who was 2 years older than I was. They were drafting at 21, so I wasn't going to be drafted, but he was. And he didn't want to go in the Army. He wanted to go in the Marine Corps. So I said, okay, I'll go with you because I had nothing else to do. But he had to go, so he left because otherwise he'd have been drafted. But I didn't have to, so I stayed home to enjoy the holidays.
And they told you they wouldn't need you till after the holidays.
Yeah, the recruiting stations were full, and not to try to come until after the holidays. So that sounded good to me, but of course then here came Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, and how do you remember that day? Everybody seems to remember where they were and how they found out.
Yeah, I hear people say, well, the ones who were here when Kennedy was killed or something. Never forget where they were. Well, I have, but I remember so clearly Pearl Harbor. I had a friend had a job at a service station on a Sunday, and he wanted the day off, and he talked me into coming down and working in his place. And in the afternoon, a man came in from Avenal, and he wanted gasoline. He had one of those newfangled radios in his car. Never heard of such a thing before, but he did. And he said, something really incredible's happened. He said, the Japanese have attacked us. Do you know where Pearl Harbor is? And I said, no, you know it. But that's, I remember so clearly pumping gas in his car while he was telling me the Japanese had attacked us at Pearl Harbor. And that was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Did it register that since you had enlisted in the Marine Corps, they might want you back a little sooner than you thought?
It wasn't necessarily they wanted me back. I wanted back.
You wanted to be
I wanted to be there that afternoon. I just felt that I needed to be there to, as if the world depended on me to be in there. As if the weight of the country did. As I say, that was Sunday. Monday, I was in Fresno at the recruiting station saying I'm ready to go. And yet, millions of other young men had done the same thing. So I had to wait until the 10th of January before I was actually sworn in.
You know, I've had some guys tell me that once they went in the Marine Corps and they got to boot camp, they had no idea what they were in for. And other guys say, you know, I did so much growing up, I was already tough, and that was no big deal. What was it like for you?
I got to sleep till 5 in the morning. Many times on the farm, we got up at 4 to milk the cows, so it wasn't anything for me. I was tough, and the attitude kind of shocked me, you know, this unquestioned obedience, you know, to a young man of at that time. We questioned everything. We quickly learned not to.
Or you were going to be in some pain, huh?
You were going to suffer for it, yes. The thing at that time that they told us that I found hard to believe, but very shortly after I did believe it with all my heart and still do, is once a Marine, always a Marine. And that going through training and being in it with all your heart, you will always be, I will be a Marine the day I die. As if I was still in my green uniform.
I have the feeling, I'm just guessing here, just going off what you've told me so far, but I have a feeling you were eager to get overseas and get involved.
Very much so, very much so. However, you have to realize that we were prepared to fight World War I all over again. We weren't preparing for anything new at all. So our training, we were great at marching, we were great at instant obedience, but we were not prepared for jungles or open area fighting or anything like that. We would have done great in France in the trenches, but nobody could envision what World War II came to be, although actually it became a lot almost like trench warfare because the Marine Corps just had the theory that if we're going to fight for an island or something, if we just do it as quickly as we can, even though we lose a lot of people to start with, in the end we will lose less than if we just slowly peck at it. So some of our battles were absolutely horrible, like the Battle of Tarawa, where we lost 3,000 or 4,000 men in 72 hours.
Yeah.
But the commanding officer at Tarawa had bragged that 1 million men couldn't take it in 1,000 years, and the Marine Corps took it in 72 hours. You know, I really was a buck private in the rear ranks, so I had no authority, I had nothing. But I was an intelligent young man, I could see what was going on. I just really can't describe it. It was unbelievably horrible sometimes.
Well, and I want to hear about some of that. You mentioned Tarawa.
I wasn't there.
Right. These happened after. This is what I'm getting at. People hear about Tarawa and Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and the casualty numbers are just staggering. But you were involved in a battle that lasted months and months and months, and more than 7,000 Americans died, and more than that many were wounded. Guadalcanal, and very few people who were involved in that battle are alive today. We'll mark the 75th anniversary later this year. Had you ever heard of Guadalcanal?
No.
What did you know as you were heading overseas? How much did they tell you?
They didn't tell us a thing till we were out to sea about 3 days. And at that time, they told us we were going to invade the British Solomon Islands. The name Guadalcanal wasn't mentioned. It was British Solomon Islands. And the reason being, the Japanese were building an airfield there. And if the airfield was allowed to continue to be built, it would isolate New Zealand and Australia from the United States. And all the Japanese would have to do to take those countries is walk ashore. Because all of their men, their army, was in the Middle East, fighting the Germans in the Middle East. and all of their navy was in the European area and the Mediterranean. So they were sitting there totally helpless. So that was a battle we had to win or lose Australia and New Zealand. Mm-hmm. If this airfield was allowed to be completed, and the Japanese, they already had control of the air. Mm-hmm. They had control of the sea. Every battle we fought them, we lost, except for
Midway. Well, and if Midway was the turning point from a naval perspective, right. Guadalcanal was the turning point in the Pacific War. From a land-based perspective. But tell me about your first taste of it, because you weren't on Guadalcanal at first.
No, Guadalcanal only had about 700 Japanese people on it, and most of them were Korean laborers who were building that airfield. And when the Marines came ashore there, they just all ran away. So there was no fighting when they landed on Guadalcanal.
There was fighting later.
There was fighting later.
But yeah. You ended up on some places most people have never heard of.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
About 26 miles away was the big island of Tulagi, and there was a beautiful harbor there at Tulagi, consisting of Tulagi and the island of Florida. And in the harbor were two small islands about the size of city blocks, and one of them had been the headquarters for the British in the British Solomon Islands, a beautiful, beautiful island called Gavutu. And on it was supposedly, according to military intelligence, the Japanese headquarters with about 50 headquarter-type personnel. Mm-hmm. When in reality, Gavutu had 800 people on it, and Tanambogo had 1,500. And the mountains had been hollowed out and full of caves and areas like that. So anyhow, knowing there were 50 people on there, the Marine Corps put a battalion of paratroops landing by Higgins boats on there. Well, instantly they were in over their heads. In fact, I met one of those paratroops here in Porterville years and years later. We got to talking. He told me what he'd been, and I said, "You remember Marines who came to help you out?" He said, "Yeah, when I saw that line of Higgins boats coming," he said, "I thought we had a chance to live." You know, he said, "Until then, I knew we didn't have a chance to live." And that was me coming, you know.
Yeah. But, so you're heading ashore.
Yeah.
And you are 20 years old?
Yes.
Never been in combat before?
No.
So what did you have on you as you're riding in that Higgins boat?
The average Marine was armed with World War I equipment, Springfield rifles, and Browning air-cooled machine guns. And I had a Browning automatic rifle, which was the same as an air-cooled machine gun, except it was able to carry by hand. Mm-hmm. Because of an expert rifle shot, they hung one of those on me. 19 pounds for the rifle and 12 pounds for the ammunition. We were in khaki. We carried a pack. We carried a gas mask.
There's another holdover from World War I, huh?
Yes, indeed. So when we first went over the side, that's the first thing we threw away was our gas mask. And very shortly, we got rid of everything. Inside of 2 weeks, what every Marine was carrying was a poncho, a mess gear, anything you could eat, your rifle, ammunition. If you could find them, at least 2 canteens of water, because that's the most precious thing there was. Not one, but at least 2, 3 if you could find them. Mm-hmm. And that's what we carried. All the rest of this stuff we threw away. One of the most almost ridiculous things that ever happened was before we went ashore, we were given a piece of white cotton muslin, or whatever you'd call it, about 6 foot long. And the idea was at night you wrapped it around your stomach and went to sleep on the ground, and that kept you warm.
You saying it didn't work?
It didn't work. But believe it or not, we were given that. And we went ashore there with, in those days they called them sea rations.
Yeah.
And they were little cans of food about the size of a can of Campbell's soup. You got a can of beans, hash, or stew. That was the 3 items they had. And we went ashore with 6 cans, 2 meals. We never got another thing to eat there for 26 days.
Let that statement soak in a little while we take our first commercial break, and prepare to be amazed by how Jim survived when an American bomb headed directly toward his position. Find photos of Jim now and as a strapping young Marine at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure.
Paul Everts RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and three locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everts RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with the guy who is personifying that mantra of once a Marine, always a Marine. At nearly 96 years old, Jim McCrory of Porterville, California has an amazing memory and an incredible story to tell. We'll hear what he experienced on Guadalcanal, but when we left off, he was 26 miles away from there on the tiny island of Gavutu, right next to its twin, Tanambogo. Two places you've probably never heard of, and as we're about to hear, two places where Jim came oh so close to giving his life for our country.
We secured Gavutu, and then I was ordered up on top of the hill. There was Hill 150 and 149. And the reason is because they were 150 and 149 foot tall. That's the designation. But anyhow, we were going to assault Tanambogo, and they wanted all automatic weapons on top of this hill to fire over on Tanambogo, which was about 400 yards away and connected with what they called the causeway, which was a road that had been coral dredged up and piled up and made a road between the two.
So again, these two islands are both in the harbor.
Right,
they're connected
inside
by
the
this
harbor.
Little causeway.
Connected by this little
so
causeway.
So you're firing from a high point
over
on
the
Gavutu over to Tanambogo.
Right, and it was so far that my tracers were actually burning out before they got there. I couldn't aim or anything, but I could do like a garden hose. I could watch my tracers and tell where my bullets were going. So anyhow, I was up there for a few minutes firing, and there was people like me, and there had been a Jap observation point up there where they had dug a pit about 8 by 8 and built a roof over it. And unknown to us, there was a Japanese flag on top of that roof. And there was a squadron of SBDs from the Enterprise bombing Tanambogo, just circling around and wanted to peel off and bomb and come up. And this guy, I looked up and I saw him point right at me. And I saw that 500-pound bomb detached from his airplane. So instead of getting up and running, he was probably 1,200 foot high or something. I just got on my hands and knees and I went backwards as fast as I could go down that hill. And before the bomb went off, I must have got maybe this much of the curve of the hill between me and the bomb. And it went off and everything turned black. And I thought, I remember so clearly my thinking. I thought, well, I'm dead. Then it turned gray. I thought, well, I'm not dead. And I looked up and I could see 2x4 and pieces of tin and stuff circling in the air. And I thought, well, those will kill me when they come down. But they didn't, except that I was stone deaf. Mm. However, that bomb lit right on top of the roof of that building. We had two complete sets of air-cooled 30 caliber Browning machine guns with their crews in there. And those people, we didn't find bodies. They were gone, just totally vanished. And then there were several other men wounded, but I was not. As I say, I just had this shock, this deafness and concussion. And 500-pound bomb is this big around and that high, you know. They're not a little bitty thing.
Very destructive.
They'll sink a ship.
And so everybody listening understands here. So you had taken this position.
Yes.
Not knowing that above you is flying a Japanese flag.
No, I did not know that. Nor did anyone else, or we'd have got it down.
You couldn't see it from where you were
coming.
No,
it was on. There was a corrugated metal roof over this observation point. Mm-hmm. And this flag was flat on this corrugated iron roof.
How did you guys find out about the flag?
Because somebody found it later. It didn't totally destroy.
Ah, they found it in the rubble.
Found it in the rubble.
So
still on some of the metal.
So no one can fault this SBD dive bomber pilot for seeing a Japanese flag and
we did not fault him, even though, you know, it's called friendly fire.
Yep.
We did not fault the man. But the instant that happened, they all vanished in a flash because I'm sure the others were saying, hey, the ones who knew, but we did not fault him.
The story you're telling really underscores how a real minute detail can have a huge life or death impact on people.
Correct.
No one had any idea that flag's up there.
Had no idea.
And you say those bodies were disintegrated.
They were gone.
How many people do you think were killed?
In that little group were eight, and there were probably three more killed up and down the top of that little hill. And then there were a lot who were like me, you know, were shocked or deafened or whatever. In fact, this friend of mine who maybe the rest of the time there was never more than 3 or 4 foot from me. When these people were killed, this is horrible. I'll tell you some horrible things, make you sick. Blood flew. There's a lot of blood in 8 or 10 people. And this friend of mine was drenched in this blood. He was as shocked as I was. And he got a few splinters of shrapnel in his arms. But he wasn't really injured. And when the corpsman came up there, they saw him all bloody. And they asked him, you know, what's wrong with you? And he said, I'm okay, you know. But they thought he was out of his mind from the bomb. So they forced him onto a stretcher and took him down to the aid station where they cleaned him up and they found out there was nothing wrong with him. Then they chewed him for having used 4 stretcher bearers and taking up the doctor's time and stuff.
Even though he told him he was
fine. Though he kept trying to tell him he was okay. But would you believe a man drenched in blood or a bomb had detonated maybe 30 foot from his head was okay?
Well, and how far were you from where it detonated?
Probably 25, 30 foot.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but my interpretation of what you've shared with me is that by any reasonable expectation, you should not have survived that.
I should not, no. No, it was by the grace of God, by scooting backwards on my hands and knees, I probably got that much of the curve of the mountain between me and the bomb.
Yeah, and like a foot or so. Uh-huh.
Yeah, if you get that much, it will throw the impact up. Or if I hadn't have had that, I would have disintegrated like the rest of them.
You had about a foot of overhang that redirected
the shrapnel. I would estimate
that,
yes.
Uh-huh.
Because this all took place in seconds. When I looked up and I could see the bomb turn loose,
yeah.
You know, it's like somebody throws a rock at you. You know where it's going to hit? Well, I knew it was going to hit me.
Mm-hmm.
I could see it. So all, and there was nothing I could do. I couldn't get up and run. I didn't have time. So that's where I said I scooted backwards. I only had seconds to do it, so I couldn't have got more than 25 or 30 foot down the mountain. So I'm only guessing.
So your life is spared.
Yes.
But you told us you couldn't hear anything.
Not for 2 or 3 days.
2 or 3 days. Mm-hmm. How did you communicate for those 2 or 3 days?
We just didn't.
Did you get any nicks or scratches or anything else from it?
I did not.
Nothing. Wow.
And the whole time on Guadalcanal and everywhere else, outside of this eye being damaged by the front sight of a Springfield rifle, I never got a scratch. However, there was fungus and stuff so bad that we all had terrible rotten spots that went clear to the bone on us, ulcers. They were so, if you'd get a scratch on your leg, it would turn into an ulcer. I've still got dimples on my legs from
I don't want to dwell on, you know, this horrible stuff, but I just want to understand what it was like to be you. Again, you're 20 years old.
Yeah.
You just almost died. You can't hear a thing. You don't know if you're ever going to hear anything again. And a bunch of the guys that you had been there with just got vaporized by one of your own bombs.
Yes.
How do you handle that? How do you deal with that?
Some people can and some people can't. I happen to be one who could. However, not as well as I thought. If I had something to occupy me all the time, I could deal with it all my life. But my first wife was a schizophrenic, and taking care of her occupied me completely. But when I lost her, I began to get terrible attacks of PTSD because I was not totally occupied.
So when your mind has time to wander, that's where it goes.
When my mind has time to wander, it goes to all those dead faces looking at me and that sort of thing.
Wow.
Because we killed so many Japanese, and I don't know if it's my imagination or not, but it seems to me like dead people die on their back looking at you. Because I still only remember these faces, and we killed literally, well, we killed 800 Japanese on that one island, and when we took Tanambogo, we killed 1,500 over there. And these were about the size of city blocks. So there were bodies actually in places stacked on each other, 3 deep or 4 deep.
And you're speaking in the present tense. This is not something that you're over your past. You know that you're still susceptible to these flashbacks and these bouts of PTSD.
Yes, I am. And this is a very worrisome thing for me about the young men of today, because I know that these young men who were in Iraq and there are not over that at all, just because they're out of there. It's going to be all their lives.
And you said some people can deal with it, some can't.
That's
and you
correct.
Could.
And I could.
What was that? What gave you that ability?
I have no idea. I can look at five people, or you could, or anybody, and not a one of us has the ability to look at one of them and say, that guy's tough, he can take it. You never know till you're in it.
And you were.
And I was.
Well, I just have to imagine then, too, that if you can't hear for 3 days, when you finally do start to hear some faint little whispers, that had to be a pretty good feeling.
It was. I was afraid that I'd be deaf for life. In fact, we had one corporal who was. Corporal Miller would never regain his hearing.
So this is the first time that your life is almost taken, but there's still a lot of work to do. You're going over to this neighboring island.
The plan to take the next island was that they would put a company of Marines, I believe it was L Company, on the beach with two light tanks, and then that we would charge, believe this or not, 400 yards across this causeway right into a machine gun bunker. Again, I say that that's what courage is, I guess. It's being able to do what you're asked to do, no matter how frightened you are or how much you think, I'm not going to make it. And our platoon was ordered to make a bayonet charge right straight across this causeway into this bunker. So
and again,
we
this
did.
This is a narrow strip.
Probably 30 foot wide.
30 feet wide, water on either side.
Right.
So there's only one place you guys can be coming from.
Right, and one place to go.
And you're going straight at?
Going straight at it, and there's a bunker made out of 55-gallon gasoline drums filled with sand, and like four deep and three deep and two deep, and railroad ties over the top, and then whole thing covered with sand and machine guns in it.
But yet you're still here. So what happened?
They shot over my head.
And you said a bayonet charge.
Yeah, but of course I didn't have a bayonet. I had a BAR, but I kept up the best I could with all that weight. And we got over there. Somebody went in with I remember they took a Tommy and went in and killed the Japanese inside the bunker. And then we were still getting fire, and I looked up and I saw a flash, and there were a row of coconut palms along the beach. And the Japanese had tied men up in those palm trees. And, of course, my BAR is a light Browning machine gun, and it just shredded those coconut palms. They had them tied with a rope. You could see a body drop like that. So then I just automatically went the next and the next. And
once you saw that one tree had a sniper, you
tree,
figured they all did.
I figured they all did. Uh-huh. And then, in the meantime, let me set you up with what was happening. They had brought a company of Marines ashore on a rather flat beach part of it, and they brought these two tanks, and between us and them was a slight rise that we couldn't see over, so we couldn't see what was happening. So we kept going, and we came up over that, and the Japanese were inside this mountain, and they had swarmed out, hundreds of them, and swarmed over these tanks, and they brought crowbars and stuff like that and jammed in the tank tracks, and one of the tanks had eyes centered on a coconut stump. And they got them stopped and poured gasoline on them and set them on fire. But two guys got out of one tank and ran over, and there was a powder room there. And they got in there and closed the door and hid out in that room. But anyhow, as we came over, here were these hundreds of Japanese on these tanks. And we began firing our machine guns, my BAR and stuff, into them. And then they panicked when they were out there being slaughtered like fish in a barrel, and tried to get back in the mountain, and the entrance to it was like a concrete pipe, maybe 40 inches round, but several hundred men can't get in that pipe at one time. So they panicked and ran for it, and they piled up against the entrance like they had on the tanks. So again, we killed them by the dozens and dozens there. And this is going to sound preposterous, but it's the absolute truth.
All right.
Around the tanks, say 30, 40 foot around the tanks, the bodies were piled up on top of each other from 2 to 3 foot high, just bodies piled on each other. And out 50 to 60, 70 foot, they were touching each other. And then between there and to where we began killing them that way into the entrance to the mountain, again, they were bodies there, and then they were touching, and then they were piled on each other around the entrance. It's just unbelievable. They're just mountains of these bodies. And now the horrible deal starts. We killed everyone we could find. We killed them all. In fact, before we got off the ship, Americans wouldn't believe this, but this is what really happened. Our colonel came on the ship's intercom, and he said, I don't know what's on that island, men, but he said, when it's all over, I want everything dead except my Marines. Now, in real wartime, you're not supposed to say things like that, but that's what our colonel told us.
Well, in the explanation retroactively that I've heard so often is that Americans came to learn about Japanese forces that they were going to fight to the death no matter what.
But they didn't know it then.
That's what
they
I was going to ask you.
They only learned it from us. Yeah, yeah, our corpsmen wore red crosses and didn't carry weapons for one day. And then they became targets with their red cross. So pretty quick their red crosses came off and a 45 came on their side. And from then on, the Geneva Convention was no more. But our colonel said, I want nothing left alive but my Marines.
Well, you knew what your marching orders were then.
Yes.
You said something about courage there. No matter how scared you are, knowing that this could be it, still charging ahead. How scared were you? Can you describe that?
Actually, I don't know that I was so frightened as I was just resigned. We kind of, in a short while, began to get the attitude that we're going to die. I'm just not dead yet. But why worry about it? Because I am dead. I'm not going to get out of this alive. So that's kind of the attitude we had. I'm dead. Why worry about it?
You never expected to come back.
I never expected to live through it.
So this whole story that you've been telling us, I think very few people are even aware that those two tiny little islands exist.
Yeah, they are.
And we've heard about, you know, Tarawa and a tiny strip of land with so many casualties. You said each of these islands is about a city block?
Yes, just not over a city block.
Yet you guys wiped out over 2,000 Japanese on those
2,300.
Wow. So once those two islands are secure, you're nowhere near home free. You have no idea how long you're going to be over in this part of the world.
And that's when we begin to starve, because the Japanese have total control of the ocean and the sky, and we have what food we came ashore with.
So, which you said was enough for 2 days.
And we were there 2 days. I mean, it was 2 days of fighting.
And you said it was 26 days before you got...
It was 26 days before a little, they called them APDs, World War I destroyers that had been modified, came slipping in one evening and throwed wooden boxes of food over the side. Never even stopped. He was afraid to stop and unload. Just kicked them over the side. But anyhow, there were a lot of palm trees on there. And I learned that top of palm trees is very edible and tastes about like cabbage. I ate a lot of that. I could go out on a reef and catch crabs.
You ate palm leaves?
I ate the top of the palm tree, where the leaves are forming and coming out.
Uh-huh.
I ate that.
So it's still real green and
yes,
flexible? And you can bite it?
Yeah, it's like the cabbage core.
So you had to climb the palm tree to do
no,
that?
No, they were all blown down by shellfire.
Oh, you grabbed the ones that were on the ground.
I just had to get the ones on the ground.
Okay.
I liked it. I like cabbage. Still do.
Uh-huh.
And the Japanese had a large thing that they stored rice in, and there was a lot of rice in it, including rat manure, which was the black rice, and the white rice was the edible. So we picked the black rice out and boiled the white. We ate that, and they left bales and bales of seaweed. They eat lots of seaweed.
So you found a way to survive.
I survived. And our main problem to start with was water. We had no water. And somebody found a little spring, a stream of water about as big as my thumb. They instantly got jerry cans over there and put an armed guard on it. And for a day or two, we just had a canteen of water per day.
There were so many factors threatening his survival, but Jim McCrory is still here at 95, almost 96. And he hasn't even taken us onto the island of Guadalcanal yet. He'll do that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. And you know, you, the listener, have always been such a big part of this show. All the best ideas come from you. I want to thank Tamsin Munger for letting me know about her cousin, Jim McCrory, and his remarkable story. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find photos and even a brief video of Jim explaining how he survived that close encounter with a bomb on Gavutu. But now it's time for Jim to take us to Guadalcanal.
The fighting on Guadalcanal got so intense as a Japanese began bringing reinforcements in that they found one night they got some Higgins boats and slipped us over there in the night in Higgins boats, 26 miles across open channel there.
Right. So if anyone had seen you on the way, they could have blown you out of the water.
Right.
And you don't know what you're going to find when you get there.
We really didn't. We could hear the gunfire across there, uh-huh. Cannon fire.
So what's going through your mind on that 26-mile boat ride?
I don't know. We were all there together, so we just, you know, that's the most important thing in the world. You are with your friends, and you can't let your friends down. That's the most important thing of all. You never let your friends down.
So what?
Nor do they let you down.
Or else you might not be here.
That's correct. One of them saved my life so easily that you couldn't believe it.
Well, I don't want to forget to hear that story, but tell me what happened when you came ashore on Guadalcanal.
Well, we were assigned to beach defense. When the British came there, they planted coconut palms, great big plantations of coconut palms. Coconut palms were behind the beach. In about 3 days, we noticed some activity 3/4 mile over to the east of us. Guadalcanal, the defenses there were between two rivers, one over here, and then a defense like this between them. And on this river, the Japanese had landed a regiment that was so famous, instead of being a number, it was known by the colonel's name, and they landed him in the wrong place. They landed him here, and he needed to be here. They had never, ever been defeated or even slowed down, so he decided, instead of marching around us to get over here, he would just come through us. And he started to, and he had about 800-900 men. Before it was over, we killed every one of them. That's where I really remember the faces looking at me, because this river came out, and he was coming across the sand part where it goes into the ocean, and these guys were dying on their backs there. Through the night, a tide came in and put sand over a lot of their bodies to a certain extent. But the next morning, when we were looking for some who were still alive or some survivors, here are these faces looking at me, and I see them to this day. These faces staring at me, just hundreds of them, you know. But can you imagine a man? They are so sure of their own abilities or whatever, and totally able to do anything with anybody, that they're going to try to come right through a bunch of Marines, dug in, ready for them. But he tried, and he killed all these men doing it. And right. They all, I guess, willingly. I mean, none of them tried to get away. They all kept coming.
He had them convinced they were invincible, yeah. Probably.
Invincible.
So 900 of the enemy gunned down in how long a time period?
About 3 hours.
Wow.
They got so close, we had 37-millimeter anti-tank guns, but besides high explosives and anti-tank rounds, they also fire a round called canister, which is like a shotgun shell, or really buckshot, I guess you'd say. And what I saw, I don't know if they're all the same, what I saw looked like it was full of pieces of welding rod, and it's used when the enemy's within 75 yards or less. And we were firing canister. That's how close they were.
It's anti-personnel rounds.
Anti-personnel rounds, yeah. Yes. That's the only time I ever saw canister used. But these men just kept coming. They never stopped. They came till they died.
Well, and you've described for us multiple situations now.
Oh, where, there's a jillion more.
Yeah, where the enemy is slaughtered, and you still see that in your brain. But do you remember times where you had to deal with losing someone that you had come to know
yes.
and respect?
Yes, one time we had been out on a push, we called them, where we went out through the country and came back and tried to capture Japanese in the circle and then come back to our base and wipe them out as we came. When that was over, we came to the Tanaru River, and we went into a patch of jungle. And they said, okay, just crap out here. So we did. And we'd only been there an hour or so. We hadn't dug foxholes or anything. And this was real thick jungle. You couldn't see the sky or anything. And we heard bombings. The Japanese bombed us 3 times a day. They bombed us at 9 in the morning, 1 in the afternoon, and 5 in the afternoon.
Clockwork every day.
Clockwork. They had total control of the sky. They were 180 miles away, and they had all these aircraft. So anyhow, we heard these aircraft, and then we heard bombs. Well, bombs don't make much noise. they barely whisper when they come down. So when you hear a bomb, you know you're in deep doo-doo.
It's too late.
Too late. So we could hear these bombs. And in this jungle, I understand they were ficus trees, but I can't really say for sure. But these giant trees had big roots that came out from like 12 foot up and came way out and formed places between them. So where I was just laying on the ground, I jumped and ran and got in one of those spaces between these tree roots, and the bombs began to hit. And I don't know how many bombs there were, but there was at least a squadron of Jap Betty bombers. And I understand they carried 2,200 pounds bombs. And these were the anti-personnel bombs. Mm. So there were a lot of bombs, 50 and 100 pound bombs. And they just kept roaring there for a while. And then it was all over. And you could look up and see the sky. There wasn't a leaf in a tree. And it was real quiet for a while. And then the wounded began to scream. And people began yelling for corpsmen and so on. Again, I didn't get a scratch. But after I got up and moved out of there, somebody said, "Hey, Mac, weren't you sitting in there?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Look at that hole." And when I sat down, the hole was right here behind my head. But I didn't get a scratch.
So there was a hole in the tree where something had hit.
Where something had gone into it. I took a straw and probed in, and it went a long way. And that's right where my head was. How that happened, I don't know.
Wow. I had asked you about losing buddies. Did you lose some in that?
Oh, they dropped those bombs exactly on us. And our platoon only lost two or three men. The second and third platoons, to start with, we had 50 men in a platoon. Mm-hmm. 50 men and one officer. The company had 257 men and officers. By now, we were down to probably 30 from disease and wounds and so on, from 50 down to 30.
Okay.
But anyhow, when all the bombing was over and they got all the people out, people were just gone. We didn't know who had been sick and hauled out or anything. So the first sergeant, old Danny, the only way he could figure to find out who was left was just fall us in and see who was left. When you're in the military, you learn to, when you're called to fall in, to pick a spot, and everybody automatically picks a spot where there's room for their buddies and stuff to fill in. So at any point, you look over there, and if it's kind of ragged, you know the men aren't there. Well, the second and third platoon should have had at least 30 men. The second platoon had maybe six, and the third platoon had 14 or 15. And these men mostly had just vanished. There were little pieces of bone and meat on a tree this big.
Size of your thumb or smaller.
Size of the end of my thumb. Little pieces of human tissue on a tree. Then that was all that was left of them. They were gone from those bombs because we didn't have foxholes or anything. I was just lucky to get between those. In fact, I talked to the last officer who died here 3-4 years ago, Mr. Riggs, and he was saying how those trees saved his life. They saved my life. I don't know how many men we lost, but we lost a whole bunch. And that fact that they vanished like that has quite an effect on you, you know. They're just gone. And again, I could take it. I don't know why I was able to take it, but I was.
And why you kept surviving when you easily could
have been
killed?
Why did I keep surviving? The bombs were just as aimed at me as anybody else.
And I want to come back to that thought, but you mentioned something else. You said a friend of yours saved your life?
Yes. We were out on a push. We were leaving our lines and heading towards the Japanese, and we were going through one of these planted coconut groves. A Japanese Zero had been shot down, and he came and he landed between these coconut trees, and the trees knocked his wings off. But the fuselage went along and stopped. And as I was going along, I could see the fuselage ahead of me, and there was a coconut tree down across the path, and I stepped over it, and I looked down, and there was a Japanese pilot laying there who I thought was dead in his flying suit and his boots, and he's just laying there. So I stepped over him and started going, and I heard bow, and I turned around, and he had a little leather piece on his belt, and he had a 25 Beretta pistol, and he had pulled it out, was going to shoot me in the back. And this friend of mine, Jim Hine, was right behind me and saw this and killed him that 2 seconds after I stepped over him.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's how close I made it.
Yeah, your list of close calls goes on and on here, Jim. It's pretty incredible. And you mentioned the Japanese Betty bombers coming in and just pelting you guys with bombs and obliterating some of your troops. And then here's a Japanese fighter plane, and that pilot almost killed you. What about the Americans who are up in those skies fighting the Japanese planes?
If you want heroes from Guadalcanal, those are the true heroes. To start with, we had a squadron of F-4 F-3s, the old Wildcats. Due to accidents and no field, just mud and so on, and lack of gasoline even, didn't have enough gasoline to fill up enough to fly at one time. We were sometimes down as low as 3 fighter planes, generally about 5 or 6, but sometimes as low as 3. And these Marine pilots would take those planes, and there might be 2 squadrons of Betty bombers coming from Rabaul, which would be about 36 airplanes, escorted by maybe 50 Zeros, and these pilots would go up and engage them. But they finally, I mean, it was suicide to go up and just tangle with them. So we had a primitive radar, and we could pick them up 90 miles away, which was about half an hour. And these pilots would start their planes and get as high as they could get waiting for them. Then when they got over the field bombing, they would come down as fast as they could and shoot at them as they came through them, then go under them and come up and shoot at them again, and then run like hell. They were true heroes. Joe Foss, John Smith, Marion Carl, they're just legendary men. Us on the ground allowed them to be fighter pilots there on Guadalcanal. Us on the ground, they wouldn't be there. And, of course, without them, probably we wouldn't be there.
And eventually, what you guys did on Guadalcanal allowed a lot of American pilots to fly from Henderson Field.
Yes, that's who killed Yamamoto later.
That's
from Henderson Field.
Right. But we're talking months and months that you were there.
Yeah. I was there from the 7th of August, 1942, to the 31st of January, 1943.
So that's almost 6 months.
Yeah.
Was that combat every day?
No, not as such. But it was being bombed every day and every night. And at any time of day, or not day, but night, there might be a Japanese battle fleet come up and shell you. And unless you've been shelled by battleships, you don't know what it is like. One night they brought 3 battleships and I don't know how many cruisers and destroyers, and for 3 hours they laid out there and laid it on us. And somebody, I don't know who, could count them, and they hit us with 845 battleship shells. That's from 11.5 to 14-inch shells. And General Vandergrift said that unless you've lived through it, there's no use trying to describe it to you. That's how horrible it is. But when one of those shells hit, they blew a hole about 8 foot deep and about 40 foot across, like a jewel or something, a real even hole.
Mm-hmm.
But the ground shook, and it shook and shook and shook. And then you shook, and you shook and shook.
If you were still alive.
If you were still alive. And looking back, I really am amazed at most of us. We were so incredibly ill. Physically ill from disease, malaria, and all of that, yet none of us ever asked to go to the hospital or anything.
Mm.
We would just lay on the dirt and suffer till we got over it. Next time we got up and went with our unit. And nobody ever asked to be relieved or go to sick bay or anything.
What kept you going through all that? I mean, you've seen guys killed. You've almost been killed. You're dealing with all kinds of horrible sights and smells and sounds.
Because everybody I was with was going through it too.
That brotherhood, huh?
That brotherhood, yes. Yeah, that's the only reason I can say. Should have been hospitalized within a month of being there. You know, should have been hospitalized within 2 days for being crazy. But
you're one of the last ones. There aren't too many Marines still with us who are on Guadalcanal who fought in this brutal battle. So what do we need to know about those guys you served with?
That they were willing to give everything for the country and their friends. This group of people that you, and I'm going to use the word love, we actually, I'm sure, loved each other as brothers. You couldn't let them down. That was a whole basic thing. You could not let your other people that you were with down.
So you came back to the States after Guadalcanal, right?
No. We went to New Zealand.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And I spent until August in New Zealand.
Uh-huh.
And they were getting geared up to go to Tarawa.
Yeah.
But I wasn't physically fit anymore, so they sent me home. Still had malaria and never got over it till probably 1950. No longer fit for combat at all. Got filariasis, yellow jaundice. I probably didn't weigh over 140 pounds.
Mm.
And when I went in the Marine Corps, I was 175, and tough young man.
Don't take this as minimizing what you went through, because I'll be the last person to do that. But maybe being in that kind of shape saved your life.
Could well have been, yes. Who knows? Otherwise, I went to Tarawa.
Yeah.
My second Marines were the ones that took Tarawa. Jim Hine, who saved my life on Guadalcanal, died on Tarawa.
And there were many that died there.
Many, many. Well, could have saved my life.
Well, and when you think back on that, you hear you've had 75 years almost to reflect on what you went through there. Do you ever stop and say, how in the world did I survive all that?
No, I never really gave it that thought, just as if it was foreordained. I don't know.
How did what you went through over those 6 months, how has that impacted the way you've lived since then?
It's made me able to cope with whatever comes along because I can always say I can handle it. You know, I never get panicky about anything. No matter what happens, I don't panic. And I really can handle anything. You can if you don't panic.
Well, I'm sure you've got a million more stories. And if there's something else that's important to you, I want you to share it. But I don't want to forget to thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that only you could tell us.
Well, thank you very much. Do you know that thanks for your service is, in my mind, fairly new? Just the last few years, people have said, thank you for your service. And that is very important to a veteran. I really appreciate it.
You know how many times you came close to not coming home?
Oh, and dozens.
And you know, 7,000, more than 7,000 Americans died in the Battle of Guadalcanal. 406,000 in the war. All these years later, how do we need to remember those who died?
Just as young men who did what they felt was correct for their country to the best of their ability, and try to remember that they were young, virile men who had everything to give to the country, and they weren't here anymore to give it. The country was at a big loss for not having them.
A great loss and a heavy price paid for what was gained, freedom for Americans and so many more around the world. That is Jim McCrory. He'll turn 96 next month, and he did have quite a few more stories that I couldn't quite squeeze into our radio time today, but you can still hear them if you pull up the podcast version at hometownheroesradio.com. I don't know about you, but Jim's account of his experiences in the Pacific sure taught me a lot today. Thanks so much for spending this time with us. I'm Paul Leffler, stating in four words what Jim's story made so painfully but heroically clear. Freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses going to your heart, you just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor. Thanks for finding the podcast version of Jim's story here on hometownheroesradio.com. As I said, he had much more to say, so let's listen in to some more of his recollections right now.
When I brought up that characterization of the enemy as an enemy that would fight to the death, and that maybe there was even honor in that for their side.
That is really not the way we saw the Japanese, and we never could understand it. We would have fought to the death.
Yeah.
And we would have taken everyone with us we possibly could. or if we could have got away, we'd have run and fought as guerrillas. Mm-hmm. But the Japanese didn't fight to the death. They died. And many times that meant suicide or something. Now, what that gained, I do not know. And none of us ever did. Right. If you're going to die, why not at least take as many of the enemy with you as you can?
Yeah.
But they didn't. They, when it became hopeless, they began committing suicide.
You mentioned your medics, your corpsmen, getting shot because they had the Red Cross.
Right.
They're supposed to be non-combatants.
Right.
I bet that angered you a little bit.
It did, very much so.
So then it's all bets are off?
All
We're
bets
not holding
are off.
Back anything?
Not going to. Although after a few days, the rage kind of subsided. And later on, we found a Japanese colonel and about a... There were a lot of really young boys on there. And a young boy in a hole covered with metal. And we didn't kill them. I don't know whatever happened to them. The Japanese Navy had young boys in it, like British midshipmen. And there were a lot of these really young boys there on the island, like 13, 14 years old. Mm. And we killed a lot of those. And there was also the finest Japanese troops there were, a battalion of Japanese Marines from Manchuria.
Mm-hmm.
Big men. And I always thought, very simple thing, Manchuria, they ate wheat instead of rice.
Huh.
In Japan, they eat rice. I have no idea, but that was my idea. Our platoon had to make patrols behind enemy lines, 7,000 yards behind enemy lines. Stay there 3 days, see what you could see, and then try to get back to your own line. So we made three patrols, and I went to Mr. Donahue, our lieutenant, and I said, Mr. Donahue, we've made three of these patrols, and nobody else has made any. I said, isn't it time somebody else took some of that? And he said, you know, Jim, he said, I thought the same thing. So he said, I asked the captain, and the captain said, when you don't come back, I'll send somebody else.
That makes you feel valued, doesn't
that
it?
That made me feel very valued, yes. Because I can guarantee you, when you're 7,000 behind Japanese line, and you know what's going to happen to you if for some reason you can't escape from them, you're not feeling very good about it, and to have to go back and go back and go back. In fact, we were on a hill on one of those patrols looking down one night, and we saw this big battle erupt all up and down our lines. And they fought all night. And so we didn't move. We stayed there. And the next night, they fought all that night. And the next night, there was no fighting. So the next morning, we said, I wonder who won. You know, we're there. We don't know who won. Is there Japanese in control now or
right.
still Marines? So the lieutenant said, guys, I'm going to try to go back. He said, you can go with me if you want, or you can cut and run for the hills. You make your choice. So we decided to go with him, and we had won. But imagine how that makes you feel.
Boy, that guy had some courage, didn't he, that lieutenant?
Yeah. Well.
Said he's going with or without you.
He's going. Yeah, he's going. It was his duty to go back, uh-huh. and we could go with him.
Uh-huh.
But he wasn't ordering us to.
Right. I have a feeling he knew what you guys were going to say.
Probably.
Because he knew what you were made of.
The name was J.J. Donahue. Very good man. I really like Mr. Donahue.
What was it like to finally get off of that, off of Guadalcanal?
That's where I began making the trips in the middle of the night. So it was still a big adventure.
Yeah.
In fact, from Tulagi, we also went to Florida and became coast watchers. Just two or three of us mm-hmm. in the jungle looking for Japanese ships coming patrolling over there, warning Guadalcanal before they got there.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that for maybe a month on Florida with coast watchers. So did a lot of things like that.
How much of that 6 months that you spent over there would you say you spent either starving or really sick?
I was sick the entire time.
The entire time.
Starving, really bad, probably 3 weeks, and hungry, really hungry for 4 months before they begin getting lots of food in.
I just want people to hear that because no one else goes through anything like that.
Well, after I got home, I read the newspapers. And there wasn't anything in it like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was a glorious victory, and the terrible things were never mentioned. I was telling her about things I'm ashamed of the Marines did. Some of them went around the dead Japanese, cut their ears off, dried them, and made a necklace out of them.
Mm-hmm.
Other people cut their heads in two and took the gold teeth out. But none of that was ever mentioned here in the United States.
Right.
We were all clean, living, wonderful American boys.
Well, I want to ask you eventually what you are proud of, but I also want to understand what it was like to come home after going through all of that.
Well, I don't know, to a whole new world. You know, the thing that really sticks in my memory more than anything else, my dad and my girlfriend came down to San Diego to get me. We were coming home, and we cut to Bakersfield. I could smell the new-mown hay. And that's probably the most important memory I have of that time, smelling that new mown alfalfa. You talk about a memory coming into my heart.
Mm-hmm. Here you've had 75 years almost to reflect on what you went through there. Do you ever stop and say, how in the world did I survive all that?
No, I never really gave it that thought, just as if it was foreordained. I don't know.
Do you believe that? Do you believe that God was looking out for you?
You know, I have to. I'm ashamed of myself, but I personally never really thought much of God in those days. Some people got religion real quick, but I would have been ashamed of myself if being afraid made me get religion. Mm. I looked at it that way. Mm-hmm. I couldn't run to God for protection if I wasn't already firmly in the church and so on.
Sure.
So I didn't. I probably a wrong way to look at it, but I just didn't want to do that.
You didn't want to be a phony?
No, I didn't want to be a phony.
Yeah. Doesn't seem to me like you are a phony.
Well, I hope not. I've probably told you some untruths, but only because I don't remember them as untrue.
Sure.
I've tried to be strictly honest. You see, on Guadalcanal, like I said, we were 180 miles from Bougainville, and they had all their aircraft and everything up there. Mm-hmm. And those planes flew 180 miles an hour, the bombers. So in an hour, they could come from Bougainville, bomb us, and go back probably in 2 hours and 10, 15 minutes. And no opposition, except these heroes we were talking about. So they would refuel, rearm, and come down three times a day. Then at night, they sent a float plane or something down with just a few little tiny bombs on it, just fly around and keep us awake.
Right.
And they did it all the time, every day.
Just an absolute miserable existence.
Yes.
And
frightening.
And so many occasions where you easily could have been killed.
Oh, yes.
And maybe should have been killed by any, you know, logical assessment.
Yeah, I remember one time I had dysentery so bad that I'd soiled everything I could put on. Mm-hmm. So I went to the lieutenant. We weren't far from the river. And I told him, you know, that, gee, I've soiled all my clothes. I need to go to the river and wash and bathe. And so he said, yeah, take off, Mac. So he gave me a pair of his jumpers to wear.
Mm-hmm.
And the officers wore like a set of clothes that just zipped up or buttoned in those days up the front.
Right.
And on the back it said Lieutenant J.J. Donahue, stenciled. So when I got my clothes washed and got myself bathed, I was almost at the supply station. So I never said this, I'm Lieutenant Donahue, but I went down to the supply tent and I made a point to, well, he could see what I was dressed in anyhow, and immediately called me sir, and I needed a pair of shoes. The soles were falling off my shoe. So I got a new pair of shoes. I got about three or four pair of socks, all on the strength of wearing Lieutenant Donahue's coveralls.
Uh-huh. I think you're the first guy I've ever met who benefited from dysentery.
Oh, I had dysentery. All of us did. We had dysentery. So actually, this is horrible. But there were so many dead bodies, and you had so much trouble getting them buried in those tropical times before they rotted and the flies got to them and stuff, that when you got food, you would take a spoonful, bring it to your mouth. There were so many flies on it, you learned to go.
You have to blow it off right before you stick it in your mouth.
Blow the flies off before you stuck it in your mouth.
Wow.
So no wonder you got dysentery.
Well, and all of these things are important for us to hear because it helps us understand how much we can take for granted.
Well, now as I look back, I'd be damned if I understand it, really. I can't imagine living in those conditions. Can you imagine sitting there eating a can of rations and blowing the flies off before you put it in your mouth? I couldn't put it in my mouth now if a fly had been on it.
Yeah. Right after you almost got killed and your buddies got killed and you don't know if you're going to survive. So let me ask it this way. if a new neighbor moved in here at Porterville Convalescent and told you the story that you just told me of everything that you went through during the Battle of Guadalcanal?
I'd probably not believe it. However, I will say that people like myself who have been combat veterans don't really try to fool us, because we can see your phony a mile away.
What's the first indication?
I don't know. You just feel it. Right after World War II, I believe the figures are something like, for every man that's out on the pointy end of the spear, there's 19 behind him. So there really aren't that many real combat veterans.
Right.
And everybody who was a truck driver or something in Europe kind of wanted people here to believe he was chasing Germans or something, you know. And so you got a lot of phony tales. There really weren't that many real combat veterans. You had all the people in training camps. You had the truck drivers. You had the supply. You had all of that kind of stuff. They all took people and people and people till you finally got somebody with a rifle.
And that was you.
Well, I had a BAR.
Yeah. You're a step ahead. Well, and I understand that you've never been a guy to look for attention for what you did.
I hope I didn't.
And is it true that you never even got your medals?
I got the ones that say I was there, but I never earned a medal. I mean, by a medal, I mean one that said you're a hero, you know, that kind, like a Bronze Star or Silver Star. Mine were just I was there type. The end of the war one, the victory in the Pacific, and a good conduct ribbon for completing a enlistment honorably.
Uh-huh.
And
how'd you pull that off?
I don't know. Didn't get caught. I have a presidential unit citation that our unit would receive from Roosevelt, and of course I can wear it with the blue star because I was one of the ones who got it.
Yeah.
But it's not. A personal heroic type medal. It's just for being a good soldier. And that's the kind I have, but they're not medals per se. I mm-hmm. would think of a medal as being a Silver Star or sure. Navy Cross or Medal of Honor or something like that. No, I never got it. In fact, I never, or most of the people like me, never cared a great deal for the way of awarding medals. We thought most of them were real phony. I was telling Tammy this corporal, when we first got on to Gavutu, within 30 foot of the beach, a palm tree had been blown down, and there was a Japanese crushed under it. Hmm. He was still alive, but he didn't have a weapon or anything, so we just looked at the poor guy and walked by him and heard a shot and looked back, and this corporal had shot him. And we never thought anything more about it till we got to New Zealand, and he was presented with the Silver Star for killing that Japanese. Well, now that kind of turns your stomach.
Yeah.
If you want to give somebody a Silver Star, give them to somebody like me who made that bayonet charge.
Yeah.
Actually, the thing that probably almost all of us went through and came to realize, and after talking with my friends, I realized we all felt the same way, is after a short bit of while, we decided we were going to die, and there was no point in worrying about it. Mm-hmm. We're dead, not right now, but sometime we're dead. Don't worry about it. You know, whatever comes along, if it didn't kill you today, it will tomorrow, so don't sweat it.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody felt the same way. And you kind of carry that through even today. You know, I know I'm going to die. Don't sweat it.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of the ultimate paradox, isn't
yes, it? Yes, it is.
Die to live.
Yeah.
Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you want us to know?
No, because I could talk forever.
How about this? I told you I was going to ask you this, so you're forewarned. Approaching your 96th birthday, what would you say you're most proud of?
I'm most proud of the fact I never let a friend down. Even after the war, I never let a friend down. Even today, then I'm very proud of that fact.
Once a Marine, always a Marine.
I hope so. And that even goes for people who are not. But I've never intentionally ever let anyone down.
Not to be salacious here, but you talked about being scared and then getting to that point where you said, you know, we just figured we were dead. But when you reflect back on it now, what do you think was the worst? What was the scariest or most horrific situation you found
yourself
in?
Making that bayonet charge across that causeway right into those machine guns. And I'm running along and the guy right next to me goes over backwards. And there's just a pink cloud of blood, just like pink fog. And then other men begin And when you're hit like that, you're running forward, let's go over backwards. And I think that was the worst of all. And then that night, a young man named McLeod and I were assigned to guard that causeway. Now, that causeway, 400 yards long, just the two of us out on it. And there had been piers there built out of cubes made out of steel, and they were blown all apart, and these cubes were floating in the ocean. And there was a slight current there, so they were floating along. But once in a while, you'd see one going against the current. Well, you could bet there was a Jap behind it trying to get back, because when the fighting started, a lot ran away.
Sure.
And in the night, they were trying to come back. So you had to sink that current or that cube and kill that Japanese. And we did that all night. And in the middle of the night, my gun jammed, and it was pouring rain. And we had learned to completely work on those guns blindfolded. We had to be able to do everything in the world with them blindfolded.
Mm-hmm.
And in this pouring rain and the dark, I was able to completely take my trigger mechanism apart, find a very small broken spring, replace it, and get the gun going again.
What kind of weather did you guys deal with there?
Very moist, but not incredibly hot. Probably average of 90 degrees, but probably 99% saturation.
The humidity was intense.
Humidity.
Yeah.
A small rain every day. In the jungle, the trees never stopped dripping. The floor was always wet. And something I'd never seen being a San Joaquin Valley boy was fireflies and phosphorescent.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd kick a log or something, and this great clouds of phosphorescent would go flying in the air. And here would be fireflies dancing around. And that was just amazing to me to see that in the jungle.
Sure. That could give away your position, too, though, couldn't it?
Yes, we learned it very quickly. At night, unless you can't help it, never fire your weapon, because there's a tongue of fire comes out about 4 foot and give you away, boom. So you never want to fire unless you just have to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if a lot of people are firing, then you're all right. But if you fire by yourself, you're in deep doo-doo. When I look back at it and just take myself out of the story, it's an incredible story.
I asked you about, you know, all these situations. You make it out of all these situations when, you know, the odds say you probably shouldn't. And I asked you about, you know, the God factor. And you said, hey, I didn't want to be a phony. I didn't want to go run into a God I didn't know and didn't care about. Is that the perspective you still have now, or have all these years?
In the last 4 or 5 years, I was married to a wonderful woman. I lost her, and somehow or other, the man that was working on my computer, I found out was a minister, and I became very interested in religion and decided I really wanted to accept God, and I asked to be baptized, and about 3 years ago I was, and it's really been a wonderful thing in my life. So at this late age and after all those years, I wasn't rejecting God. Mm-hmm. I just didn't want to be a phony, and I didn't know if I was worthy of, that's the right way to put it,
mm-hmm.
am I worthy of going and saying, here I am, God, you know, I want to be part of you. I really wondered, was I worthy?
So when you look back on it now, with the understanding that you have now, do you feel that God was protecting you, or was it just luck?
I don't know.
It's hard when you know how many others were killed, I
yes.
imagine. So why me and not them?
Yeah, I have no idea. Why me and not them? I never got a scratch. The only scratch I got was this eye.
Yeah.
And I finally paid for it after 75 years.
You just started having trouble with it?
No, I just woke up one morning, I was blind.
Mm.
The old injuries had allowed blood to come in the inside
and
filled it up with blood.
So now you can only see out of your left?
Right.
Uh-huh. That's like an Abbott and Costello routine right there, huh? I said you can only say out of your left, you say right. Well, and that's kind of the ultimate irony, huh? For all the enemy actions that you survived.
A friend's rifle caught me. You see some of the most ungodly, strange things. One friend of mine, his tin hat had a hole in it that went right in here between his eyes, came out right here behind, and he had a burnt circle around his head. The bullet had come in here, circled the inside of his helmet several times, went straight out the back, and only made a burn mark on his head.
Mm-hmm. Hard to explain, huh?
I can't.
Yeah.
How could that be? Mm-hmm. But I saw it. I was sitting right next to another guy, and he had his rifle across his lap. A breech or the stock of it was over here. And all at once he went, oh, and I heard the bullet hit. And I thought, oh, he's hit in the stomach. Well, he had a big bruise on his stomach, but the bullet had hit the stock of his rifle and slammed it into his midsection.
Mm-hmm. What are the odds?
And I was walking where we were back to the airfield. There was a small hill between us, and the Japanese had a cannon. They could only fire like every 20 minutes, and they were every 20 minutes they'd send a shell over, and they had to send it over the top of this ridge to try to hit the field. And I was walking along there, and there was a guy maybe 75 yards ahead of me, and all at once he had no head. And this shell from 3 or 4 miles over here had come and just over the ridge and hit him in the head.
Man, unbelievable.
Yeah, these things are unbelievable.